So in the old writings, it was said that each case, the energy is withdrawn from the center and brought to the one above it. And when the focus of attention is carried away from one to the next, then the serpent conquers the lower one, because its source of extreme activity is removed. Then the power of that chakra or center is available when necessary, but never is it an inevitable pressure. It can be called upon at any time, because man has the power to move his consciousness at will from one center of his own nature to another. But these centers will no longer operate independent of his own will, or will they force energy into excessive emotional patterns. Thus he overcomes. He is St. George. He slays the dragon. He conquers, like Siegfried, the strange being Fafnir, who guards the treasure of the Nibelung. And the ascent in the Raja Yoga pattern is therefore the gradual removal of energy pressure from these centers by the motion of the center of awareness upward. First, from the first or lower to the second, from the second to the third, from the third to the fourth. And in this way, the neophyte or candidate climbs the ladder. In this way, he ascends the silken cord described in Muhammad's vision. In this way, he also passes through the initiations of the Mithraic mysteries. Because now we have to remember that in Raja Yoga, we have a series of steps or stages by means of which all of the essential principles of the other yogas are renewed and revived in the mind of the disciple. Thus, Raja Yoga begins with physical discipline and includes all that is necessary in what the Greeks call the cathartic methods. We have the individual learning by experience that his body is a wonderful instrument, but a very poor master. That the body is his servant, and that just as a wise master is thoughtful and just of his servant, just as the wise governor thinks first of the good of his people, so the human being must not overcome his body by subjecting it to tyranny or abuse, but through the clarification as an experience within himself of his duties to his body and his body's duties to him. And out of the entire procedure on the level of catharsis comes the recognition that the body, restored as far as possible to a completely normal and proper state, is the most useful instrument. For as distempers and disorders of the mind afflict the reason, so pains, miseries, and infirmities of the flesh prevent the composure and the natural integration of the human character. Also, the body is a kind of sounding board, an instrument, which catches the sympathetic tones of the soul music. And if this body is defective, it will impair both the mental and emotional life of the person. It will not result in this emotional and mental life being prevented from evil manifestations. Rather, it will merely disable, disfigure, and contribute further to the difficulties of external and internal adjustments. So the body is brought under disciplines. these disciplines being thoughtfulness, watchfulness, care. Later into the same process of discipline, the yoga system introduces posture. It introduces certain positions of the body, many of them exceedingly difficult to assume and requiring great study and thought. The purposes of these postures are two. The first, that the individual shall gain the power to cause the body to obey him, even into a most difficult situation. And second, because under certain phases of yoga, the electric magnetic currents of the body are caused to modify their forces and to change their rhythms according to posture. Other things likewise are added to this part of the discipline. But in sum and total, the purpose of these first stages is to clear the channels to the objective manifestation of man. Yoga teaches, for example, that the infirmities of age do not mean the infirmities of the soul, primarily, but the inability of the body to continue to distribute the energies of the soul itself. Therefore, what appears to be the failing of the mind or the loss of the energies of living should not be interpreted that these energies have failed, but that the body can no longer distribute them. Thus, to keep the body as far as possible in a condition to accomplish the maximum release of the internal is important. But this does not justify an extreme athletics in which the body is cultured, but the soul is left untutored. Or else we will have the famous description which Plato refers to when mentioning Alcibiades, when he spoke of this rich, powerful, and luxurious young man as a leaden dagger in a jeweled sheath. And it is not valuable that the body should be so ornamented that it overshadows the soul. Nor is there any need that a bad soul should have a good body. And perhaps we should realize that the reason for the growth of the body is because it is required by the inner life, and not at the expense of the inner life. So all things in moderation and order, and the disciple then passes on to the particular and definite problems of this soul life itself. And here he comes under what might be termed those rules by which the seven deadly sins can be transformed into the seven cardinal virtues. And not by the negative rejection of sin, but by the recognition that all energies and their right relations are good, and that what we call evil is not a principle, but a perversion of good things, and that the psychic life of man has a place, has a purpose, has a reality, but that it cannot function and fulfill that reality until it comes under the sovereignty of the will. Just as the body must be governed, so the soul must be governed. For the being and the soul are not the same. The being uses the soul even as the being and the soul together use the body. As an instrument of its purposes, the soul is a valuable and glorious thing, what the Egyptian called the jewel of seven stars. But as a source of the ministrations of mankind, the soul is as fallible as the body. A man governed by his body is in trouble. The same man governed by his soul in its present condition is also in trouble. Because in Eastern philosophy, the soul does not have the spiritual connotation that it has in Christian theology. We think now of the victory of soul over body, but that is also achieved in the chronic alcoholic. He has a complete victory of a negative psychic pattern over his physical life, and that is just as much a victory of the soul over the body as the visions and mysteries and ecstasies of the saint. So unless the soul is entitled to leadership, to act as a regent over body, it should not occupy this exalted estate. But a good soul in a sound body is a very handsome combination, the virtues of which cannot be overestimated. So having gotten the body under a certain amount of discipline, or more discipline than possible, a discipline which does not inhibit, a discipline which does not frustrate, but a discipline which dedicates, which brings things into their proper places and makes all things good, because through proper discipline, each part fulfills itself. When we discipline the child, it is not because we hate the child, but because we desire the child to be good, to have virtue, and to become a constructive citizen. When we discipline the body, it is not because we hate it, but because it is our child and must be taught to do those things which are necessary for its good as well as the good of the being that inhabits it. And it is with the same attitude that we approach the redemption and regeneration of the psychic nature. Now, on one level of the psychic nature, we have the passion natures of man, the intensities of hates and fears. We have greed and envy. We have all these specters that haunt the haunted house of our own internal life and that clank their chains at night in the disturbances of dreams, like the ghost of Hamlet's father wandering the ramparts of Elsinore. So this psychic ghost world must also be put in order. It must be gradually brought into the realization that the redemption or regeneration of passion leads to compassion. And all personal emotions, when regenerated, release their universal import. Therefore, in their more constructive aspects, things are less personal and more universal, because all motion of consciousness is toward universality. For universality is union. It is that which is most necessary to achieve universals. As Plotinus defines it, the journey of the alone to the alone. The journey of the awaking all and its final union with the all. One by one, then, through disciplines, we begin to educate the powers of the soul. We educate them, and by so doing, we moderate them. It has been often observed that the more educated or enlightened an individual becomes, the less likely he is to engage in discourse. We know, therefore, that to a certain degree, wisdom impairs action. Well, there is less objective activity where there is greater thoughtfulness. The individual who knows very little is certain of everything and throws himself headlong against a solid wall. The thoughtful person does not make such exuberant misuses of energy. He has learned better. So obviously and objectively, he is less active. Actually, his activity is more meaningful. It is an enlightened action rather than merely a tremendous expenditure of natural reserve. In these disciplines, what do we observe then? That the person gradually comes to understand the simplicities of value. He begins to recognize the dangers of his own mind, the dangers of his own reasoning power, the dangers of his own imaginings and his own intemperances. He learns to realize that the soul cannot solve its problem, but that it may become a wonderful and useful instrument for a greater purpose once it has been brought into a state of cultivation. Thus, this part of Raja Yoga may be described as the civilizing of the soul. Being brought from a savage and barbaric state, finally into a condition of culture. The civilized human being is the person who actually has achieved a certain internal poise, a certain control over the excesses of himself. A civilized human being can abide with others in a compatible association. And the soul, which is civilized, can abide with its own parts in a compatible state. And then as the discipline goes on, we find it becomes a little more severe, because it is pressed gradually toward the end of bringing all of these intensities to a condition in which they relax away to their own moderation. Mystics have always had this type of experience in some way, because mysticism belongs to the level of the soul. Mysticism is a psychic level. It is the level which works with emotion and which is attended by vision, trance, and mystery. The soul is mystery, and it is so veiled in the ancient allegories. So mysticism seeks gradually the benevolent experience within itself. And as Havelock Ellis reports in his Dance of Life, a very unusual report, because it is not often that an intellectualist is a mystic. It is a comparatively uncommon experience to find this. But here is a scientist, a man of attainment, who describes a mystical experience which happened to him, and which was to him a revelation which relaxed all tension within himself, removed all doubt, made fear impossible. In other words, it brought to the end for him the tyranny of psychic pressure. And that is the thing that the central parts of the disciplines of Raja Yoga is concerned with. It is the relaxation of dangerous pressures within the psychic life of a person. Whether these pressures are to the level of appetite and to emotional excess, or whether these pressures take the form of religious fanaticism, it is very little difference. The individual who is unbalanced in his devotions is as bad as the individual who is unbalanced in his vices. It is, again, an extreme condition, dangerous to the temperance of the soul. From these central disciplines, which include, therefore, various types of training, usually inclined or so directed as to gradually reveal to the individual that he is the victim of the excesses of delusion within himself, so that he experiences the fact that he is not able to trust his own feelings. Gradually he escapes from this peculiar bondage that we have in the West. In the West, a man says, "I feel, therefore I do." It never occurs to him to go against his own moods. He does not know whether this mood arises from his spiritual nature, or, as Samuel Johnson used to say, from a drop of green bile in his gallbladder. He doesn't know where the pressure comes from, but whatever it is, that pressure he must obey. I feel like it, therefore I do it. And, of course, as a result of that, we're in trouble most of the time. The disciplines point out that because the individual has an inclination or has a pressure, does not mean that he has to simply give in to it. Nor does it mean that he is going to frustrate himself, clench his teeth, and deny it. The answer lies to examine it, and gradually, through his own enlightenment, to dispel it because it is no longer valid. That in his thoughtfulness and in his relaxation, he knows that this pressure is not himself and does not bear witness to the true nature and quality of his own consciousness. So one by one, pressures are moderated. And there are two ways, of course, of moderating them. One is symbolically on the outside, and the other is factually on the inside. And these parallels of symbolism work together. For instance, a man has spent all his life saving his money, and he finally has quite a tidy sum. Now his religion may tell him that he shouldn't have all that money. Then comes a very serious emergency in his own consciousness. If in his own conviction he comes to that point where he realizes that he should spend some part of that money to help someone less fortunate than himself, and he does so, this is an experience symbolically. Because by the action, which is a form of mudra, by the action of giving, he has stated giving within himself. He has released something of the intensity of his own soul when he was able to part with some part of his own material goods. Later, through understanding, perhaps, he renounces all his worldly treasures, and in so doing, states also the renunciation of his own instinct to accumulate, which is the basic problem, not the things he has accumulated. It is the will to accumulate that assembles the symbolic objects. But when this individual decides that it is more important for him to become than it is to possess, he transmutes an instinct. Sometimes the physical action must come first because it represents a strenuous dedication on a level where the enlightenment does not yet exist. But it must gradually be followed by an internal renunciation. Now, it is easy to renounce many of the things we have. I know people who can give away everything they have, but they can never spare an opinion. That is sacred. I've heard people say, I've given away a fortune, but don't ask me to like my brother-in-law. That is an attitude I can't give up. That is more important to me than all the money in the world. Or another one will take some other cherished fetish, which he continues to possess. And always possession is symbolized by the thing possessed. To release the thing is to state from the outside to the inside the release of a pressure. Whereas the release of the internal incentive may mean the falling away of the external things. Now, in yoga, there is no great virtue, essentially, in a man being poor. The only reason is that on the level of conduct, very few individuals can afford to be rich because of the damage it does to them. If they could afford to be rich, there is no reason why they shouldn't be. But when they are, it is very likely they become absolute servants and slaves to what they have. They are not wise administrators. They are possessors, hugging their possessions to themselves and dying locked in the embrace of things. This is dangerous. Not because the things are bad, but because the individual has become addicted to the wrong series of values. If he has the right values, he may possess anything. Seek ye first the kingdom of heaven and its righteousness, and all other things shall be added unto you. Now, many individuals have taken that to mean that by certain spiritual affirmations they can become millionaires. That is not the principle. It means that only the individual who is completely oriented in his own spiritual life can afford to have things. Anyone else who has them is possessed by them and locked in with them in a hopeless bondage. So Raja Yoga begins to break away these attachments. It breaks them away rationally. It breaks them away persuasively. It breaks them away by recourse to the great religious incentives of the true believers. It makes virtues out of regeneration and renunciation. But the purpose is always the same. It is not important what a man renounces. It is that the man renounces the impulse to possess. Because as long as that impulse remains, he's going to be subject to illusion. And the energy of his being is going to be channeled into that accumulative and acquisitive process. He's going to be like the blinded Samson, who was bound to the millstone of the Philistines. A divine power bound to mortgages, chattels, foreclosures, bank accounts, and taxes. Now, as long as that locking remains, that individual can never be a citizen of the universe. So in the central parts of Rajayoga, there is this process of preparation. The individual gradually silences the pressures and tensions of his own soul. And he fashions out of the soul itself, by its complete regeneration, by its complete transformation, he transforms it into the Arhat Self. He transforms it into the transcendent being, which is a new psychic nature, the psychic nature of the fabled Rishi of the Indian legend. The saint is actually every man's sanctified soul, the saint within. It is the soul that has been separated from its intensities, and by that virtue alone has become an intercessor between the outer and inner life of man. Thus, in most religions, even beyond the borders of Christendom, the intercession of saints, or the power of sanctified persons to carry the supplications of the faithful to their spiritual Father in heaven. Such beliefs exist. But this sanctified Arhat, this canonized saint, is the redeemed psychic self. And the most simple and natural way in which a saint is canonized in the Catholic Church is martyrdom. Therefore, again, it is the soul that dies for its faith, or is gradually reduced from its intensities, so that its intensities die, that is suitable for canonization. The other type of saint is the result of the proof of miracles. So what do we have? We have the soul as the wonder worker, the great yogin. We have the soul as the magician. We have the soul like Prospero in the Tempest, who waving his magic wand can change the face of all things. We have the soul as a kind of guru also, an inner teacher. But only after it has passed along the traditional road, has itself achieved the purification, and has attained to its own natural destiny. So the teacher within can become the soul, for the soul is also the abode of the seven liberal arts and sciences. It is the abode of all the great laws, the great principles of geometry and mathematics, astronomy, music, architecture, medicine, law, all these things, because they belong to the mental psychic life of man, are all resident in the soul power. So the soul becomes the physician, the legislator, the creator, within its own emotional level. And it is then regenerated, redeemed from its original and former state of disorder and asymmetry. The soul is the natural abode of the beautiful. And the beautiful is that which is in order of peace. And out of the redemption or regeneration of the soul, through discipline, comes what the Rosicrucian Meyer calls the silentum post tenoris, the silence after the sounds, or after the noise. And the confusion or noise is man's negative psychic life, and the silence is that which comes when the soul is in order, and all things have achieved their proper place. Now the soul, when it is thus ordered, becomes the vestment of glory. It becomes the psychic body of the being which inhabits it. And it also makes possible the journey onward to that which lies beyond. Because until after these consciousness has passed through the trials and tribulations of the psychic adjustment, it is not ready to hear the voice of the infinite, which speaks only in the great silence of peace, or the transcendency over confusion or discord. So we find that having climbed the ladder of the seven stars, and having conquered the seven worlds of the soul, having wandered away and finally escaped by the thread of Ariadne from the labyrinth of the Minotaur, which is again this pattern of psychic involvement, The being, the psychic nature, the Kundalini, has ascended through the seven gates, and the being approaches the mystery of illumination. Now, I tried to explain in part last week this idea of the reversal of subject-object relationship. And in this, I wanted once more to bring this point out because one or two of the friends seemed to feel there was a little uncertainty on the matter. In Eastern mysticism, we relax into a state of truth. Whereas in the Western school, we gird ourselves in the full armor of the doctrine and go out fighting for it. In the West, the concept is that truth must be conquered. We must get hold of it. We must possess it. We must be able to say, well, you don't know what you're talking about, but I know the truth. I have it. So it's a sort of a chapel that you toss around, and everyone has it, and those two people agree as to what it is. The more they talk about it, the less certain we are they have it. And by the time they've described it fully, we know they don't have it. But at the same moment, we know we have, and we're trying to get a word in between there. So that to our Western concept, truth is something that's not so different from a house or an automobile or something of that nature. It's something we can get hold of. Why do we think that way about it? Largely because we associate it with our concept of education. We assume that education is going to bestow the truth upon us. Therefore, that it is to be found in books and that it can be demonstrated by passing the examination at the end of the term. And that when we finally have the diploma, we have it all. We've got it. Now all we have to do is go out and win fame and fortune with it. That is our way of thinking. Truth is something that we admire, we adore, we venerate. We can conceive of nothing greater. And yet we seem to have the instinctive belief that it is something that we have, and we can give it to you, and you can give it back to us, and we can toss it around among our friends, and that it is something that some way we can possess. In the East, there's a little different thinking on this matter. In the first place, truth is too big for us to possess. If truth isn't bigger than we are, if it is something that we can hold in our hands, it is small indeed. Some will say, yes, it probably is tremendously simple. That's been one of the difficulties. We've always missed it because we've made it too complicated. Truth is probably indescribably simple. But it is also so simple that we cannot hold it in our hands because it disappears. It does not mean that truth is stupendous and that the more erudition we have, the nearer we are to it. It means, however, that to the Eastern concept of reality, truth is something that is so infinitely beyond the finite that man simply cannot possess it. Also in the Eastern mind, truth, as the great master of the gurus, is not something. It's not, it doesn't have sides or corners or a top and bottom. It doesn't abide somewhere. It doesn't have an appearance like a person or a thing. It isn't even a great light. It is not that type of thing at all. In the Eastern mind, truth, law, life, love, reality are all names for one thing. Truth is only a name for being. And the supreme truth for man is the simple statement that being is. You can really go not much further without beginning to get in trouble. Therefore, his acceptance of the existence of a supreme reality probably comes as close to truth as he can fashion it in thought. And an infinite tenderness toward this reality, an infinite longing, the love that is only the love of the real, is probably his nearest emotional approach to it. So his love for reality and his statement, the internal conviction of the reality of the infinite, these are probably the nearest things to truth that he can objectively understand. For in Raja Yoga, being is at the root of will. Will is emotion of being. And will itself, when freed of all involvements, is the eternal will. Man does not have, ultimately, a will of his own. He has an eternal will that is channeled through him. As long as he is the channel, the will look like him, in some way partake of him, and be measured by him, as the water is measured for the vessel which contains it. Yet if we remove the vessel, the water is formless. If we remove the personality of man, the principles within him are formless. They do not look like him. They do not think like him. They only look like him because they are moving through him. They only think like him because his mind and his brain are their temporary instruments. But these energies themselves are superior to him and have no actual limitation except an limitation of illusional appearance. Substantially, they are infinite. The very will that man experiences as the power within his own consciousness carries with it truth. Therefore, truth moves in man and through man, and it does not come to him. Truth is as identical with his own life principle itself. Thus he can never possess it, because in the first place he never lost it. And at the same time, possession implies that he can some way circumscribe it and make it his own. He cannot, because it belongs to everything. There is just as much eternal truth radiating through an unfolding flower as there is through an unfolding saint. Truth is identical, in principle, with the experience of life itself. To experience life completely is to experience truth. To experience truth completely is to experience love. And to experience love completely is to experience law. They are all one tremendous integrity. In this integrity, man lives and moves and has his being. Because there is no place where it is not. And the old Hindu says it extends to the end of the cosmos and 3 inches beyond. It goes forever and 3 inches. There is no conceivable place where there is a deprivation of it. And what appears to be a deprivation is an obscuration by form, mind, or illusion. If, therefore, man starts searching for his own nature, and he industriously traces the current of his own will to its source, he's not going to find there his own personal equivalent of an aged, bearded relative. He's not going to find a spirit in the form of an old man sitting on a throne. He's not even going to find his own spirit. Any more than he's going to find his own truth. Can we really actually conceive of truth belonging to anyone? Finally, when we think about it. Can we believe in a spirit that is a nice, separate little being sitting all by itself somewhere in the midst of space? And that this is us. This is our reality. The Indian cannot think that way. He believes that as he moves toward the source of his own consciousness, that he doesn't move toward a being sitting somewhere, or an entity, luminous or otherwise, or some mysterious little whirling spirilla of cosmic force. He does not conceive that. Because even the moderate development of his own faculties and the gradual extension of his own consciousness through discipline causes him to realize that he is moving from the small end of a funnel toward the large end, and not from the large end toward the small end. He finds that the further he goes, the fewer are his own boundaries, and that ignorance is making this little package, and that wisdom is breaking it open. That the more ignorant he is, the more personal he is. The more he thinks about himself, the less he thinks about anything else. The more he begins to experience, the broader he becomes. Well, if a man gets broader and broader and broader and keeps on getting broader long enough, he is no longer broader. He is bread. He is absorbed into the principle itself. If the individual gets better and better and better and better, we assume that sometime he will get to be best. But when we think about it more, best doesn't seem to have very much significance. It's the more flawless gem, but it's still something, because beyond even the best, we must assume something. The only way that we can move from better to better and better without coming to the end of something is to finally realize that all betterness leads towards eternal good, which is at the end. That if the individual knows enough, about enough, and learns more about enough, and keeps on learning and knowing and learning, he cannot ultimately become just wise, because that's not a little package. The only thing he can become is wisdom. The end of all attributes must be the principle. Without wisdom, no one could be wise. So wisdom, and not the wise man, is the root of things. So if the wise man goes along the currents long enough, he is going to arrive at wisdom, which is the root of all being wise. In this thinking, then, the Oriental thinks of the extension of consciousness as leading finally not to an isolated position of superiority, but to the final identification of the divided part with its own totality. And this totality is all. All of everything. All of wisdom. All of life. All of truth. All of law. And the only time the seeking can end is in totality. Because we cannot imagine a universe composed of an infinite number of separate things, all perfect. Because if they are perfect, they are alike. And if they are alike to that degree of utter sameness, our own common intelligence begins to tell us that they become one thing. Things that are absolutely alike are one thing. Because there must be some dissimilarity to keep them separate. When there is no dissimilarity, there is no longer boundary, and they move into the eternal. So man does not possess truth, but he experiences the release of truth through himself and in himself. And through the gradual refinement of consciousness and the attainment of samadhi, he comes as nearly as the human being can come and still exist to the complete experience of universality within himself. He experiences the reversal of the subject-object relationship. Instead of being the man seeking truth, he experiences, rather, truth seeking him, or coming through him, moving toward him. he approaches it, it approaches him. And finally, he comes to the experience of the relation of the parts of the whole and realizes that he can never possess it, but that it has always possessed him, but he didn't know it. And the awaking is the recognition of the state that has always been, not a different state. And this awakening cannot be a shock, and it cannot be stressful, because it is gradual. And by the time it is reached, it is the only acceptable end. Now, there have been many interpretations of the samadhi experience. Some think that it is simply a highly developed psychic state in which the individual achieves the complete transition or the complete suspension of his own faculties, and that the whole mystery is on a psychological level. I don't think that is true. I think it can be true, particularly in the practice of Hatha Yoga. But I do not believe that it is essentially true. Or, if samadhi is the experience of a being nullifying itself, voluntarily becoming nothing, nothing from nothing comes, and the ascetic practicing this and returning to objectivity would come back from a vacuum and bring nothing. Because he cannot bring something from nothing. If it is merely negation, if he is merely psychically gone to sleep rather than physically gone to sleep, then he has entered a state of non-existence, temporarily at least, and nothing returns. He can experience nothing, he can gain nothing, he can know nothing, because he has destroyed or temporarily subjugated all means of interpretation and all means of reaction. On the other hand, as in the case of Pavlok Ellis, in the actual samadhi, the consciousness passes from a state of negative into a highly positive relation. Because this transition does not end in nothing, but it ends in the experience of absolute fullness. And returning from the samadhi, the ascetic returns with a complete concept of relationship with all else that exists, with an immediate personal apperception of realities, which will cause and does cause a complete reversion or change in his life. Therefore, the state he goes into cannot be negative, because he experiences it as the solution to everything. As in the case of Ellis, who came back without doubt, fear, worry, question. He had found an absolute internal experience of sufficient and complete answer. He couldn't put it in words, but he knew from that time on that, use our phrase, God was in his heavens and all was right with the world. He knew it. Therefore, this experience cannot be negative because of its reaction upon the conduct of the person. It is therefore a glimpse of a universality of realities. It is as though the individual drank from the sea of absolute life. It isn't his sea, because others will drink from it. All will drink from it. And in so doing, they will discover that they are it. And therefore, it will be no shock to them to realize that this one great ocean of life supports the spiritual, moral, and physical life of everything, and is the energy within it, which in its own nature produces the phenomenon of will, and on the psychic level is interpreted as the libido, and on the material level as energy. It is this one life. And as the Buddhist doctrine says, the nirvana then is the experience of the groundwater turning to the feet. It is returning to a state of allness. Not a state of nothingness. Therefore, the individual is not deprived of his own precious existence. He is restored to the sublime fact of eternal existence and his eternity in it. Now, before he can appreciate and probably enjoy all of this, he must pass from the condition in which particulars are important to him, to that state in which the experience of the absolute generality is the complete fulfillment. Then he is no longer seeking for his God. He has experienced Godhood in himself and in all things that exist. But this is not a personal Godhood. This is the Godhood of the sovereignty of reality. And in reality, he is the root of everything that is so. And the only thing that man must renounce to find it is that which is not so. And he can never make that which is not so real. And he can never for one instant destroy the reality of that which is so. So his final decision to remain true to truth means that ultimately he will experience re-identification with it because it is himself. He is just as much truth as he is life. He is just as much reality as he is person, in fact, much more. So through the person is revealed to the objective and fragment of reality. But as man goes by discipline and improves, refines, enlarges, and releases, he returns to reality. He does not find it in the sense of gaining it for himself. He is simply restored to a state which is eternally his own, and from which he is separated at all times by nothing but the thin thread of his own ignorance. This, I think, is the substance that I would like you to remember in connection with the yoga principle. And I think it will help to make the subject of Raja Yoga a little clearer to you on the level of principles. Now, tonight we end this particular series. And next week, we're going to begin our study of alchemy.